This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Unusual weather patterns, including heavy rain since October, and general climate conditions are blamed for the spread of the desert locust swarms.
That's Muhammad Yusuf reporting from Nairobi. Details coming up also. Uganda has declared an outbreak of yellow fever in two of its districts. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the UN Food and Agriculture Organization has warned that an outbreak of locusts in the Horn of Africa may soon spread to other countries. Mohamed Yusuf has the report from Nairobi.
In a joint press conference Friday, the FAO and the East African regional body IGAD said locusts feeding on crops could leave millions of people without food. Bukar Tijani is the deputy head of Africa for the FAO. He gave an update on the locust migration in the region.
The infested areas, definitely Kenya, Ethiopia, Somalia, but also Eritrea. Then countries at risk in Eastern Africa, South Sudan, and also Uganda. Sudan and Egypt are also infested. So we are looking at the whole region of locusts because of these conditions, which are very suitable for locust breeding.
Unusual weather patterns, including heavy rain since October, and general climate conditions are blamed for the spread of the desert locust swarms. Theophilus Mwenda describes how the pest ruined his farm in eastern Kenya. At around 5 in the evening, yesterday locusts invaded on my farm, ate my maize, he says. In the morning, they started eating maize and other food crops on the farm. Then they started eating animal feeds. It ate everything in my farm. I don't know what to do. The United Nations Food and Agricultural Agency warns the food situation will worsen if nothing is done to stop the swarms from spreading. Tijani says people who lost their crops and food supply will need financial support.
For the food insecurity, FAO is working very closely with the World Food Programme. And in fact, they know exactly what we're doing, how we're doing, and we are making assessments so that we can look at families that have been affected, that have lost livelihoods, to support them before the next raining or harvest season.
Authorities say they are dealing with locust numbers in their billions. Stephen Joker of Desert Locust Control Organization says they are deploying aircrafts to control the swarms.
The respective governments have acquired pesticides. I want to assure the people of Ethiopia and Kenya, where we are spraying now, that the pesticides we are using are safe for non-targets, and there is not fear about poisoning. We do, of course, tell people where we are sprayed. You take some time before you go in there, and the sprayer people, the people on the ground doing ground spraying, should have protective clothing.
The FAO says the locust invasions may continue until June. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Uganda has declared an outbreak of yellow fever in two districts of Moyo in West Nile region and Bolisa in Western region. Uganda's Ministry of Health says three people have died of yellow fever. The outbreak is traced to Uganda's neighbors, South Sudan and the Democratic Republic of Congo. VOA's Catherine Nambi files this report from Kampala.
A 37-year-old farmer trading in milk between Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC, last visited Bulisa Hospital last October with a headache, vomiting and abdominal pain. He died on 4th November and blood tests studied at the Uganda Virus Research Institute confirmed he had yellow fever. Uganda's Minister of Health says seven contacts with the deceased were followed. His wife tested positive but was treated and survived. The six other contacts tested negative. Early this month, two other yellow fever cases were found at Moyo General Hospital in Moyo. Both patients died. Dr. Jane Ruth Acheng is Uganda's health minister.
In Moyo district, there are two confirmed cases. Both are males, aged 18 and 21 years. The two cases were dealing in cutting and trading timber between Uganda and South Sudan. On the 2nd January 2020, the two cases traveled from South Sudan to Moyo. Upon arrival, they got ill, and on the 3rd January 2020, they were admitted at Lugobo Health Center 3 in Moyo District.
Acheng says teams have been sent to the two districts to investigate the spread of the disease and identify contacts, the confirmed patients for isolation and monitoring.
The district health teams of Moyo and Bulisa have initiated investigations. In addition, the Ministry of Health, the World Health Organization, and the Centers for Disease Control have dispatched rapid response teams to Moyo and Bulisa districts to support investigations, active case search, and community mobilization and sensitization.
She says government plans to procure vaccines for vaccination of those between 6 months to 45 years in the two districts.
The ministry has requested for yellow fever vaccines from the International Coordination Group that manages global stockpiles of yellow fever and meningitis vaccines. We anticipate that within the next 2 weeks, vaccines will be available and vaccination will commence in Moyo and Bulisa districts.
Acheng says Uganda will discuss with partners a possibility of including the yellow fever among the vaccines offered free during routine immunizations.
The Ministry of Health has also applied to Gavi and WHO for inclusion of the yellow fever vaccination into the routine immunization schedule. Having faced 4 outbreaks, Uganda now qualifies to introduce yellow fever vaccine as a long-term measure to prevent yellow fever outbreaks.
The vaccine currently costs about $23 in Uganda, and many people have shunned it. Dr. Jonas Woldemariam is the World Health Organization country representative. He says routine vaccination is the only protection against yellow fever and promises WHO support for including it in Uganda's routine immunizations.
We are working very fast to do that. I think our target would be anywhere between 3 to 6 months as we can. We can control yellow fever if we put it in the routine system, and that the more we use it in a routine system, and that it is provided free for the vulnerable population, and that would make sure that people have the valid and authentic card. So people will get more used to it, and they would realize that it's easy to get it, to be vaccinated.
18 countries have incorporated yellow fever vaccine among their routine immunization schedules, 5 of them in Africa. The Minister of Health has appealed to all travelers in and out of the country to ensure they are vaccinated against yellow fever as way of minimizing the risk of spread of yellow fever through international travel. Ugandans are advised to sleep under mosquito net and report any suspected cases to the nearest health facility. Yellow fever is transmitted through mosquito bites. Symptoms include high fever, headache, body aches, fatigue, vomiting, blood in urine or stool, and or yellow discoloration of skin and or eyes. Those infected usually die within 7 to 10 days if not treated. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
The President of the United Nations General Assembly is leading a high-level interactive dialogue to coincide with the International Day of Education at the UN headquarters in New York today. The theme of the meeting is on aligning inclusive quality education policies with sustainable development goals. The dialogue will promote a common understanding of inclusive education and lifelong learning. It will also look for ways to strengthen quality education for all. For more on the meeting, VOA's Peter Cloti reached Tajin Mohamed Bandi, President of the UN General Assembly.
I think Friday's program is designed to bring our attention focused on the importance of education, not only for itself, in the sense that education is itself a value, but also in relation to how without quality education, none of the goals we seek to achieve under the 2030 agenda will be achieved. So our focus is to discuss particularly what achievements we have made as a global community in relation to education in terms of access and quality. We certainly have made progress in terms of the numbers of people who are able to read and write and in terms of gender issues in relation to education. But there is still a long way to go, especially in countries in conflict, but also in the poorer countries, in terms of access, in terms of quality, and in terms, in some areas of equality, in terms of gender.
Well, Mr. President, I know education is very important to you as a former academic and a diplomat as well. How do you break down the barriers or challenges that are affecting quality education to those who are in conflict areas or those countries who simply cannot afford it?
Well, I think two things. You see, first of all, to continue to remind ourselves as human beings that education is a human right, and this has been understood. Now, if we really truly value rights for all of us, then aren't we able to give a bit more, especially in support of countries that are struggling relating to education, even basic education in some cases. And in relation to areas of in conflict, many countries led by the United Nations and also supported by the United Nations in terms of advocacy have understood that it is possible to support education in conflict. And many countries are giving ideas and some support to guarantee that we do not create more problems by ignoring the real needs of children trapped in conflict.
Do you think there's a political will and or commitment to ensuring access to quality education across the continent, particularly in Africa?
I think the ministers of education in Africa, when you listen to each minister of education, will tell you what they are doing to guarantee universal education. Universal education in terms of access to basic education, whether you define it in terms of primary education or meaning 4 or 5 years of schooling or 9 years. However you define it, all African countries have understood the importance of this, but challenges remain in terms of infrastructure, in terms of number of teachers, and in terms also of the quality of the teachers, in terms of their own training. There are a lot of interesting debates in faculties of education around universities in Africa as to how best to structure primary education to guarantee that access.
That was Tijani Mohamed Bandi, President of the UN General Assembly, speaking with VOA's Peter Cloti. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. In Egypt, security forces say they are ready to face alleged threats and calls for protests this weekend to mark the anniversary of Egypt's 2011 uprising. President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi called the Arab Spring uprising a conspiracy, and there has been a campaign in the media to portray it as a time of chaos. Said Sadiq, professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about the counter-revolution trend in Egypt.
All revolutions in history have been portrayed as conspiracy. So this is a very common description by any ruling class. The Egyptian revolution has been tarnished by Islamist involvement and the deep state in Egypt. Both sides have to be blamed. Islamists got foreign support, and that also fed the conspiracy discourse in the Egyptian media. And I don't see that the regime is going to change this discourse because he lives on the internal and regional support because he is fighting revolution and all those forces that want chaos and a repeat of what is happening in Libya and Syria. Revolution in Egypt, I believe, is not going to be repeated again in the same way. After 2013, we have never seen any 1 million revolution again. I don't think this is going to, you will have that tomorrow or the next year or the year after. This is not possible these days.
Do you consider that counter-revolution?
Of course, counter-revolution is dominant, is leading the area these days. If you want to have a real revolution, you need to make a lot of changes, education, political culture, the media, the root of political power. And this has not happened since pharaonic times.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi attended on Thursday a ceremony for the 68th anniversary of National Police Day as security forces prepare to confront alleged threats and calls for protests this weekend in light of the anniversary of Egypt's 2011 uprising. Can you explain the focus on National Police Day and not the anniversary of Egyptian Revolution?
Look at Egyptian media in the last 7 years, you would find that they are equating revolution with chaos, with civil war, the example of Syria, Libya, Iraq, while police is equated with law and order, maintaining national security, fighting foreign conspiracies. I think opposition is exaggerating its power, and the government is exaggerating the threat, so that in the end, after the 25th of January, the government looks like they have been able to stand up against this threat. Egyptians tried two revolutions before, 2011-2013. They are exhausted. They just don't see that revolution is a tool for change and that reform would be better. They see the area around them that all the states are falling down. So the mood for revolution in Egypt does not exist.
Egypt's Minister of Interior said that police were ready to confront attempts by Muslim Brotherhood members to harm the country's national security during the 9th anniversary of revolution on Saturday, calling on the Egyptian people not to respond to calls for incitement, rumors, and fake news. What's your take on that?
Revolution has been linked, discredited by this linkage to the Muslim Brotherhood and the presence in foreign countries, especially Qatar and Turkey. And this promoted and helped the government and its media promote this idea about foreign conspiracy. The aim, of course, of this call is to delink the opposition, secular opposition that exists in Egypt, and we have a lot of critique of the government. But we don't want them to link up with the Muslim Brotherhood. And that discourages secular opposition from joining the call initiated by the Islamists. And we have to remember that you have many internal social forces in Egypt who fear the Islamists. So anything that comes from the Islamists, they look at it with skepticism. You have women in Egypt, 50%. You have Copts, 10%. They are afraid of the Islamists. Add to that the deep state. Add to that, there are many regional and international forces do not want trouble in Egypt. For example, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Israel, the United States, the EU after experiencing refugees from Syria, the trouble from Libya. They don't want another chaos in the Middle East, especially in Egypt, one of the biggest countries in the area.
That was Said Sadiq at the American University in Cairo, speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. Separatists in Cameroon have ignored calls by the United Nations and the Central African Bloc, CEMAC, to allow voters in the northwest and southwest regions to vote in next month's elections. Fighters have been attacking staff of the election body, ELECAM, and destroying voting materials ahead of the official launch of the campaigning on Saturday. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
François Lucene Fall, representative of the UN Secretary General in Central Africa, says Cameroonians should support their government and make the February 9 elections a success.
We are here to make an appeal to all the stakeholders in Cameroon to maintain peace and unity in this country. It's very, very important that the citizens of this country vote and choose those people who represent them.
Fall was accompanied this week to Cameroon by the Secretary General of the Economic Community of Central African States, CEMAC, Chadian-born Ahmed Alam Mee. Alam Mee said failure to hold elections may jeopardize efforts to bring peace to the north and southwest regions where separatists have waged a war for independence since 2016. The UN and CEMAC envoys arrived in Cameroon as separatist fighters in the north and southwest mounted roadblocks and either abducted or beat up civilians seen with voter cards and election materials. Electoral body ELECAM said its offices in the northwestern towns of Ndu, Kumbo and Dop have been torched and some of its workers kidnapped. Others are on the run. Patrick Esso fled from the northwestern town of Santa, where he says clashes intensified on Thursday. He says he was abducted and kept in a separatist camp for 5 hours because he was found with a voter card. Esso says it will be impossible for the elections to take place.
The President of the Republic should call for a major ceasefire.
I don't think that somebody will go and stand and say he wants to campaign while the country is in flames.
The military has clashed with separatists several times this week and said it killed at least 17 insurgents. The separatists represent English speakers who want to secede from the rest of Cameroon and its French-speaking majority. They have vowed on social media that no election will take place in the English-speaking regions they call Ambazonia. In spite of the threats and attacks, ELECAM chairman Eno Abrams Egwe says the elections will take place and promised voting will be secure.
The different headquarters of political parties must be known by the security in view to protect them. Security corridors will be put in place for the electors to move from one area to the other. Exceptionally, polling centers will be well protected. And also, all the meetings of political party leaders will be well protected.
Political parties say more than 60 people have been abducted in recent days. The separatists have promised on social media to free the abductees after the polls. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Dr. Peter Salama, Executive Director of the World Health Organization Division for Universal Health Coverage, Life Course, has died at age 51. Dr. Salama, a medical epidemiologist from Australia, joined WHO in 2016 as Executive Director of WHO's Health Emergencies Program, which he led until 2019. He was well known in Africa for his work leading UNICEF's global response to Ebola from 2009 to 2015 and served as its representative in Ethiopia and Zimbabwe. Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, WHO Director General, said, "Our hearts are broken. Pete embodied everything that is best about WHO, professionalism, commitment, and compassion." And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
VOA News.
VOA. When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.